Good morning, everyone. Let's start again with a meditation, and I want to again go back to the ultimate bodhicitta practice, the emptiness practice, and continue this slogan that we looked at that says, examine the nature of unborn awareness. And remember, as with any Vipassana practice, but particularly this type of Vipassana practice, where we're looking at the nature of the mind, then we're doing this, of course, in our direct observation. So don't allow your intellectual mind to interfere in the process, because in these sorts, any sort of Vipassana practice where we're questioning and investigating, the intellectual mind always wants to come in and give an answer. But of course, here we're not interested in our belief system. We're interested in what we observe directly. So if you see your intellectual mind coming into this investigation, just get rid of it and just use your bare attention to observe directly what's actually there. Okay? So let's do the practice. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. Settling the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now allow your eyes to be at least partially open, resting your gaze in the space in front of you. And if you find that uncomfortable, you can also try with the eyes lightly closed. And then simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. Not doing anything at all. Just be. Being aware of being aware. If you find yourself caught up in any agitation, tension, or distraction, lower your gaze, release awareness into space, releasing all appearances, relaxing completely. or if you find that you're getting caught up in dullness or simply becoming spaced out, raise your gaze and sharpen your focus, being aware of being aware. Simply resting in luminously clear awareness. Who is it that is doing the releasing and focusing? Remember, don't try to intellectually answer this question. Simply look in your direct experience. And who is resting in awareness? Are there two minds? The mind that is observing and the one that is being observed? if there is only one mind, is that the observer? If there is no observer, then who is it that knows that? And then simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in luminously clear awareness. Does anyone have any questions about that practice before we go back to the text? Good. Good. Very good. Because it's the intellectual mind that wants an answer to this. And the answer is not in the intellectual mind. So therefore, with this practice, get rid of the intellectual mind. We're not trying to intellectually answer these questions. We're trying to answer them through our direct observation. And this is another reason why shamatha practice is so helpful and beneficial for this. Because if we don't have a calm, clear mind, and we do this investigation, it's very difficult. It's like if we're looking in a room for a particular person in a crowded room, but it's dark in the room, and we look, we won't be able to see very well. So that, like that now, our mind is dark with dullness. We can't see very clearly. Or our mind is too agitated. So when we do this, and the mind is very subtle, and of course we're using the mind to observe the mind. So if the mind is either dull or agitated, very difficult to do this observation because we get agitated, we get dull, distracted. And so therefore this sort of practice doesn't go very well if we don't have a very calm, clear mind. So therefore, if we work on improving our mind in shamatha, more calm, more clear, more focused, it would be like having a very clear vision and the room full of light. And then we can see very clearly whether or not that person is in the room. And similarly, we can then very clearly see in our direct observation the answers to these questions. So again, often when we're very confused, it's because the intellectual mind is coming in going, I know, or I don't know, how can I answer that? You know, is there two minds or one or none? The intellectual mind can never get an answer to those questions.
I didn't want to answer to the question. I remain with the question.
Sure.
I remain all the
good
time, but...
Again, this is a practice that we need to do again and again and again and again. Keep looking, keep observing, and all the time try and improve our... make our mind more stable, more clear, more focused. And then this practice will get easier, and then we'll see very clearly what the reality of our mind is. So we need to be patient and, again, not allow the intellectual mind to come in, because we're just going to get very confused. Because what we're saying in this view here is that the answer is beyond duality. And the intellectual mind only works in dualistic mode. So the intellectual mind will never get an answer to this question. And even if the intellectual mind could, it's not going to help us, because we're trying to change our instinctive way of seeing things. And in simply having some vague intellectual idea of non-duality, that just in itself is not really going to help us in our life. We need to come to experience this in meditation, to have a direct taste of this. Then some changes are going to start to happen in our life. Because then we'll experientially see things in a different way in daily life. So this is important. Okay.
Question about yesterday's topic.
So
about the stage of death. But also maybe about the realms. Is it teaching by the Buddha, or is like mixing all of these?
Yeah, this is this drawing that is coming from the Buddha. I mean, this way of drawing maybe is a bit Tibetanized, but the actual diagram is coming from the Buddha. This wheel of life. It's said at the time Buddha. We talked about the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And the second one were these perfection of wisdom teachings, which are the basis of emptiness. And they were mainly taught in an area called Rajgir. And Rajgir means the place or of the king. And one of the main disciples of the Buddha there was King Bimbisara. And at one point, King Bimbisara received a precious gift from a neighboring king. And he wanted to give something back of equal value, but he didn't have anything of equal value. So he went to the Buddha and said, what can I give to this other king of equal value to what I received? And then said that the Buddha commissioned the drawing of this diagram, gave it to the king and said, give this to the other king. This is of much more value than what you received. And it said that he gave this diagram to the other king, who then studied it and reflected on it and meditated on it. And on the basis of that, he became an arhat. He achieved liberation. So that's the history of the diagram. And these stages here are coming also from direct experience. That I said that this is the process through the death process, but also in Tantra or Vajrayana, we're trying to gain access to this very subtle mind in meditation. And to do that, we more or less go through the similar process to get to that point. So then the meditators report these experiences in the meditation practice as well. This process, particularly this, generally you will only see in Tantra or Vajrayana level of practice, because this subtle and very subtle level of mind is never talked about in Theravada or in the Mahayana. So generally you'll only see this in Tantra Vajrayana, because it's only there that we have ability to do this.
So the belief it's coming straight from the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah. So also the Buddha taught Tantra Vajrayana, of course. Yes.
So I think my confusion in my mind, I'm trying to separate between what is like pure teaching of the Buddha, what came like with culture, different masters.
Right. Yeah.
Because when you look around.
Sure.
Sure.
But a couple of points on that. One, of course, is One is, it would be very difficult to prove 100% that a particular teaching actually came from the Buddha. So that's the first point.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I think we can't prove any single, even the Four Noble Truths, you wouldn't be able to conclusively prove that the Buddha taught. And maybe you're not even going to be able to conclusively prove the Buddha even existed, 100%, empirically. So that's the first point. Second point, of course, is, as the Buddha himself said, please don't merely accept what I teach out of devotion to me. You need to be like a goldsmith who checks and tests the quality of the gold before accepting it. So even if we somehow could 100% prove that this teaching came from the Buddha, we are not to blindly accept it. We have to question it. We have to check it and test it, even then. And then, of course, another point is that Prince Siddhartha was not the only person to become enlightened in the history of the world. There are many ancient Indian Tibetan masters who have also achieved enlightenment. So then they have the same experience and knowledge as the Buddha. So they are equally valid as the Buddha. So this is another point. So again, the point is really to check whatever we hear and see and put it to the test of experience. Does it make sense? Does it match our experience? Is it beneficial? Because otherwise, if we get caught up in this, is this really the Buddha's teaching or not? If it is, I'll just accept it. If it's not, I'll reject it. This is not going to be helpful, yeah, I think.
Yeah. Maybe not. It's not a reason, but sure. Sure there is. I see in my religion, so many mixing.
Exactly. And that's why we need to be like a goldsmith to check and test and see when this happens and reject it. If it's invalid, if it's not matches our experience and it's beneficial, then we reject it. I mean, even the Dalai Lama said, he said that, you know, if any of these teachings, if we can, through modern science, empirically prove that they're false, we have to reject them. Because it's antithetical to Buddhism to continue to accept something that we prove to be false.
Maybe the problem, I will need to go to a cave for 20 years.
No. See, we can do like scientists do. Scientists use what is called peer review. When they have a theory that they want to check, they have peer review, which means they have other scientists at a similar or higher level who've done this work who can check and test what they're doing. So this is an essential part of science, is this peer review process. That even if a scientist has an experiment to show something or to try and prove something and they come up with some result, it's not automatically accepted by them or the scientific community, is it? It's checked. It's checked by other scientists who've done something similar and see what their results are, whether that they can collaborate that, or whether through their understanding they can refute. Maybe this scientist came to the wrong conclusion and the other scientist says, no, here's where you went wrong in your step, in your investigation. This point here is illogical, it doesn't work. So then the other scientist would say, no, that's not right because of this and this reason, through their understanding and experience. So same with us. We can rely on the contemplatives for centuries who've done all of this work and have this peer review process going on. So this is going to be very helpful.
I think it can be compared, for instance, the first man who went to this space, or the first man who went on the top of Mount Everest, Edmund Hillary. He has his experience, because he was the first. But then, hundreds of people went to the Everest.
Sure.
And they have the experience which confirmed the experience of the first
exactly.
man.
Exactly, that's what I'm
the
saying.
Same with the space, yeah. Yes. And their experience may be even more valid because it is out to date now.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, is that this peer review process, and that's why having a qualified teacher can be very helpful, because hopefully they have had some of those higher level experiences and they can validate or refute our experiences, whether they're valid or not. So that's very important.
What about other than teachings, like rituals, making offerings, prayers, certain prayers?
Sure.
Did they come after the Buddha, or were they rituals, or were they
Well, of course, some of the things have been formulated from the basic teachings of the Buddha, like Vajrasattva practice, for example. You know, it's been packaged based on these four opponent powers, these very principles. So, of course, what we do, and this is the big challenge for Buddhism in the West, is if Buddhism is going to thrive in the West, in non-Asian countries, it has to take on a form that is digestible for the Western mind. Otherwise, it will perish. We can't pretend to be Tibetans or Japanese or Thais and pretend to do those things, because it's not going to work. Just like the Tibetans didn't pretend to be Indians. They took the Indian teachings that came, and so did the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans and the Vietnamese. They took these teachings and put them in a form that was digestible for them, which may involve packaging them in a certain way that is effective and beneficial. Of course, the big challenge is to do that without corrupting and polluting. So that's where this checking has to come in. And this is the great challenge now, I think, in our modern society, is to be able to do this work that every other country did when Buddhism came to that country. And we have to do this work, and we have to do it in a way such that we don't pollute and corrupt. And unfortunately, there seems to be at the moment a lot of this corruption going on, not so much inside of Buddhism, but more outside, in that now a lot of people are appreciating that within Buddhism there are a lot of useful things, but then what they often do is take one thing out and throw the rest out and then say, this is Buddhism. And it's not. You know, and so this is the big challenge at the moment. But we have to do this work. We can't just sort of chant Tibetan and pretend to be Tibetan. It's not going to work.
But offerings and things like that.
They all have a purpose, yes. They all have a purpose. And within the Tibetan culture, the purposes were packaged in a way that was suitable for Tibetan mind. And similarly, they were done differently in all these countries. But if you look underlying what the surface rituals or chanting or whatever, underlying is a core practice, and that's the purpose. But again, if we only operate at the superficial level and we mindlessly chant some mantras and do some nice little offerings on an altar mindlessly, it's not really, I mean, it's just, again, spiritual materialism. It's just, you know, making it, saying, oh, I'm very spiritual. Look at my altar, how beautiful it is, you know. Are you spiritual like that? I mean, we're just kidding ourselves.
I have a question. So, you know, emptiness was taught by Buddha much later. So you have different
much schools. Much later? No.
No, because you have different schools that don't really believe in the thing of emptiness, what I'm aware. So I get very confused that if
correct.
They are the same teachings of Buddha, then, and if you're trying to say that they are different cultures and they are doing a different editing, so aren't we really trying to, you know, kind of the main teachings, we are just trying to pollute it?
No. So remember that the Buddha taught according to people's ability, capacity. So he taught many different things at many different levels.
Right.
And it was, of course, the more simple levels he more widely taught, because most people could appreciate that. And that's what really started to develop widely immediately, because it was easily understood and widely accessible. And so this is like the foundation Four Noble Truths and so forth like that, where the more profound, difficult teachings he didn't teach very widely, and therefore they didn't really spread so quickly. And then they took time for them to be, and that's where we have the emptiness teachings and all of that. So it's just in that sense. So again, you know, we have these different philosophical schools based on these different teachings. And so we have to investigate all of this and see, you know, what makes sense, what's helpful to us and so forth. You know, not blindly accept anything.
Because even in Buddhism, there are a lot of division. There are so many schools and, you know, they...
And that's very useful for us, because we can look at all those schools and go, that's the one that really resonates with me and that can help me. But even so, whatever traditional school we go into, not to blindly accept it. And I mean, and this is something we'll see today, is we're not a qualified student of Buddhism if we blindly accept any teachings in any system. We're not qualified then. We need to check and test them. So even if we decide, for example, the Burmese tradition is the one that resonates with me. If we go, that's the right one, all the rest is wrong, and I'll just do whatever that says, we're definitely not a qualified student of Buddhism. Same with Tibetan. You know, we say, oh, Tibetan Buddhism, that's got Vajrayana, that's got to be the best. I'll follow that. The rest is inferior. We're not a student of Buddhism if we have this understanding.
So you're trying to say that when we talk about Burmese and all, so they have their own level of experience, and based on that, they have put in the teachings and going
forward because... Exactly. And, of course, all of these teachings are leading, as this text says, leading to the same point, directly or indirectly. So the assertion here, of course, is that even if we start with a system of teachings that doesn't talk about emptiness, but maybe just no self or something, that will lead us to this anyway. So it's like, what's the saying? All roads lead to Rome, you know? So whatever we start with, it's all heading in the right direction, and we will come to the final goal if whatever we start with will help to lead us there.
I have another question relating to that. You're saying the subtle and very subtle is only accessed by the, the Vajrayana people, Tantrak. Because if a person is a normal person and who's dying, but he has been a good human being and whatever practices he's been doing, so we're trying to say that he may not have the access to the subtle and the very subtle, because obviously the very subtle goes to the level of only a yogi who is able to get into this clear light vision and able to meditate. But say we are a normal human being and, we are dying, but, we've been a normal person.
Good.
But obviously we've not been able to reach to the level of this because we've not really practiced it.
I mean, a normal person goes through this, but we're not aware of it.
You're not aware of it.
So what's going to happen here is if we've been a good person, led an ethical life, one of our virtuous imprints will ripen here and we'll end up in a good place in the future.
That will depend after he stopped breathing? Or
no, here, before.
Here, before. Okay, while all this process is happening. So whatever...
And it's not a... We can't choose. No.
So it depends upon... Okay.
Only how we've led our life.
Yeah. One more question. When you talked about the Bardo, how much time does it take? Because you say that, gone and it's ready for the next life. So is there any particular time period that...
In the Tibetan tradition, they say a maximum of 49 days.
Okay.
How they came up with that number, I'm not sure. But my own feeling is that most cases, the Bardo is very quick. Very quick. But there's no anything in the text says X amount of time.
Okay.
The only thing is in the Tibetan tradition they say maximum 49 days. But my own personal feeling is that in general the Bardo will be very quick.
So what is the essential of beliefs for being a Buddhist? I mean, there is in any religion there is some things that are essential.
Essential.
Yeah, the core of being a Buddhist. It doesn't matter if you are Thai or Burmese or...
The core of being a Buddhist is that we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. That we have faith that the Buddha has taught something that can help us. That we have faith that the Dharma can help to liberate us from suffering. And that the spiritual community who are following those teachings can help us. So that's generally the measure of being a Buddhist. Who do we put our faith and trust in terms of overcoming suffering? And again, it's the three jewels. That's the measure of
and
being a Buddhist.
Emptiness and...
Well, yeah, the emptiness is Dharma, isn't it? I mean, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha...
So maybe I should ask, what is the essentials of the Dharma?
The essential of the Dharma is, again,
like the core of it, not traditional and other aspects that...
This is all the core. This is all the core. So, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana is core, according to Buddhism. I mean, of course, the various traditions, they have their own ideas, but here, everything we've been talking about is core. I mean, maybe it's been packaged in a certain way, but here, in the Mahayana, core to the Buddha's teachings is the idea of emptiness, that everything's empty of independent existence. Of course, as I said, there were different philosophical schools in Buddhism, and of course they disagree about this.
About the emptiness.
Yeah, so some philosophical schools in Buddhism say emptiness is nihilism, and other philosophical schools say there's no external physical reality. In fact, it's all internal to the mind. That's the Chittamatra. And then other philosophical systems in Buddhism say there is an independent objective world there. So there already are three contradictory views, all three taught by the Buddha.
And
so we have to check.
About karma and rebirth.
Yes. Okay, let's move on. We've got quite a bit to talk about today. So we've finished the first five of the 7 points in the 7-point mind training. The first, again, was the preliminaries. The second was the two main practices of wisdom and compassion, the conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. The third was how to take adverse conditions into the path, particularly through using wisdom and compassion. The fourth point that we looked at was to how to synthesize all of these practices into these five powers, the essence of Lojong or mind training practice. So we looked at that, what is the essence of this practice, these five powers in our life, and how we can use those at the time of death. And then yesterday we finished by looking at how to, the fifth point is the measure of having trained the mind. How do we know, or how can we tell if our mind training practice is going in the right direction? What are the measure of understanding and seeing that actually our mind training practice is working and that we are progressing? So we looked at that yesterday. And so today we're going to look at the last two of the 7 points. The commitments of mind training is the sixth point, and the seventh point is the precepts of mind training. So there's quite a lot of slogans here, but most of these are fairly self-explanatory. So we don't need to make a lot of commentary on them. The commitments of mind training are about, you'll see that most of those are about don't do certain things. And that is that the commitments of mind training is about avoiding things that are opposite to mind training, avoiding things that will interfere and corrupt and cause problems to our mind training. Whereas the precepts of mind training is more about the things that we need to do to help support and nurture our mind training practice. So let's have a look at those 2 points, and we'll start with the sixth point, the commitments of mind training. So here we are on page 17 at the top on the left side. So just to introduce this sixth point, I'll again read a little bit from this practice of Lojong here on page 165. We strengthen our resolve by making a serious commitment to persevere. A certain amount of commitment is an essential element in anything that requires time and effort. It's one thing to dabble casually, but an entirely different matter to become involved in something after giving it serious consideration. There are many kinds of commitments within the various Buddhist traditions, each of which have their own unique vows. Dumsik, which is a Tibetan word for commitment, is a very important concept in Tantric Buddhism, symbolizing the bond between you, the deity, or between you and the guru. In the context of mind training, commitment relates directly to the determination to resist the seductions of our samsaric tendencies. The word dumzik, which is the Tibetan word for commitment, is actually made up of 2 words. Dumcha, which means something that binds, and sik, which literally means honorary word. The English equivalent would be a pledge or oath. The idea behind being bound by words is essentially about honoring the commitments we have made to ourselves. If we have taken a vow that commits us to doing something, there is more likelihood we'll see it through to the end, because it carries more weight than some vague promissory intention. We have to abide by a commitment once we've formally declared it to others. We can't underestimate the importance of actually saying, I will practice Lojong without allowing external circumstances to interfere or to cause my practice to degenerate. We make this commitment within our capacity, to the best of our ability, and with the help of mindfulness and awareness. Nobody expects more of us than that. So let's have a look at some of these commitments here. And again, most of these are things that we are to avoid that sort of would go against mind training practice. So the first slogan here is train constantly in the three general points. So there are three general points here. It says this line expresses that your mind training should not contradict your pledges, your mind training should not become offensive, and your mind training should not be biased. So let's have a look at what each of those three general commitments are. The first point entails relinquishing all behaviors that disregard the law of karma and its results. This includes behaviors such as defying the minor precepts with the assertion, since I am training the mind, nothing can harm me, and engaging in actions that contradict the general Dharma practice with the assertion, if one has this mind training, one needs nothing else. Engage in mind training by means of your thought, while in your actions observe in a pure way all the pledges and commitments you have taken, from the opening stanzas of the ethical discipline texts up to the Vajrayana. Make sure your practice and day-to-day way of life accord with and can withstand close scrutiny judged against the three scriptural collections. So what this is saying here is that that if we just because we go into this mind training practice doesn't mean that we can disregard our ethical basis. You know, sometimes people may feel that we're doing this sort of high-level mind training practice and that supersedes ethical basis. So we don't need to worry about being ethical now because everything here is fine. So then people then disregard that. So here it's saying don't do that, that we need to maintain that ethical basis, particularly if we have taken any of these vows or precepts at the level of liberation, at the bodhisattva level or the Vajrayana level. So whatever level of practice we are engaging in, whether it's Theravada, Mahayana or Vajrayana, associated with that there's an ethical foundation, and often with that we can take on these vows. And you know, maybe Renato mentioned yesterday a little bit about the eight precepts for today. The first five are called the Pratimoksha vows, and so they are often the vows, the ethical vows that we can take at the level of Theravada. And then on top of that, we can take what's called Bodhisattva vows. And on top of that, we can take Tantric vows. And all of those vows are to really help us, particularly to adopt an ethical basis for our practice. So this point here is saying not to neglect that and to think that somehow we don't need that ethical basis anymore now that we're doing mind training. I think that's fairly straightforward. The second one is a little bit more obscure. So let's see, try and understand what the second point here says. The second point entails disregarding such obnoxious behaviors as sleeping in harmful places, felling harmful trees, visiting areas where you may contract contagious diseases, associating with people who are degenerate in their commitments, with lepers or those who are possessed by spirits. Do not act contrary to the Kadampa way of life, a great tradition that has been established by Geshe Drom Tompa at Rudring. So remember, Geshe Drom Tompa was the main disciple of Lama Ratisha. So he is really the beginning of that transmission of not only Lam Rim, but this Lojong in Tibet. And he, from him on, then of course we have this early Kadampa lineage of early Tibetan masters. Practice the teaching, and here maybe someone has some good idea what this means. This obviously is a Tibetan expression. Practice the teaching instead as if lifting all four corners of square cloth. If anyone has an idea what that means.
Unity.
Hmm?
Unity.
I've heard that before. Mm-hmm. It's when if every person is holding one end of the cloth.
Then no, I think it means we're holding all four corners.
Which is difficult.
I know, but what would be the symbolism of that?
Nothing is falling aside, because if you fall,
not falling out. We're containing everything well, maybe, that nothing's falling out if we're not holding up the four corners. You know, maybe. Anyway, something we can think about, what the symbolism of what that means. It must be obviously a Tibetan expression. Shawopa states, examine where you might go wrong. You have erred when your spiritual practice becomes offensive. Forsake consorting with those who are degenerate in their commitments or in their morality, or commit negative acts, and make sure your conduct does not become obnoxious. So it's not so clear here, I think. There's a few things mentioned here, but I think what's really it's saying here is, one thing it's really saying is that not to think somehow now that we're doing mind training, because in mind training there's that third point of being able to take adverse conditions into the path, that somehow not to think that now we're engaging in some mind training that we can just enter into any difficult situation we want and we'll be able to handle it. I think this is sort of the main point here, is not to somehow be overconfident that we'll be able to take all adverse conditions immediately into the path and put ourselves unnecessarily in very difficult situations. And that's what's being mentioned here in terms of don't come into contact with people, at our level at least, don't come into contact with people who completely overwhelm us in a negative way, because we're not going to be able to take those adverse conditions into the path.
It's like talking about balance in a way, not going to the extreme, talking about balance, also in the other thing.
Well, of course, as we advance in the path, then we'll actually need to search out these difficult situations. But I think it's what's saying here, at our level, don't do that. It's not going to be helpful.
Yeah, but even then, like, it's always going in a balanced way.
Sure.
Don't overdo anything, even if you're in a high level.
Yeah. So let's see here. I think Alan Wallace has something good to say in this point. So let's have a look at what he says here. If I can find it. Yeah. And the second point here, he says, he translates this as, do not have a sense of bravado in mind training. Imagine your practice is going well. You feel that you are rising above the vicissitudes of life and are filled with loving kindness, wisdom, and courage. The urge may arise to test out the strength of your spiritual fortitude by finding some thugs in a dark alley and overwhelming them with loving kindness. The advice here is, don't. Don't seek out dangerous situations to practice mind training. Adverse conditions will find you in their own time. So I think this is the main point here, is don't think that somehow, now that we're starting to practice mind training, we can go out in very dangerous situations and deal with them easily. Probably won't be able to.
Yeah.
Third point.
No need to swim with sharks, you
know? No, we don't need to go out and swim with sharks, no.
They're not so horrible as people make them to be.
The third point. The third point refers to the following. Some practitioners can tolerate harms caused by humans but are unable to do so in relation to non-humans. They are obsessed with demonic harms. For others, the reverse is true. Some practitioners are respectful toward important people but bully the weak. Some are affectionate toward their family but hostile toward outsiders. Others train their mind in relation to sentient beings but not in relation to elemental spirits. These attitudes are all biased. Train your mind to be free of such discriminations. So here again, I think it's fairly straightforward, is that that we are to not be biased in our mind training, but rather have this equal attitude towards others, be practicing towards others equal, this mind of equanimity, and not be favouring one over the other. So this, again, is coming back to the cognitive fusion. So if we can avoid cognitive fusion, then we can really have this mind of equanimity and really develop this mind, equal mind of loving kindness and compassion, and practice equally towards everyone and not be biased towards some people and not other people and against other people. I think that's fairly straightforward. The next point is very important, and a lot of these points coming up now have a lot to do with this. We talked briefly a couple of times yesterday about this sort of spiritual materialism, you know, this spiritual ego, that our spiritual practice is being hijacked by the ego, and we're just caught up in these eight worldly concerns, looking for praise and fame and good reputation and so forth. So here is a few, a lot of this, this comes up in a lot of the following slogans. So let's have a look at the first one. Transform your attitudes, but remain as you are. While practicing the exchange of self and others and reflecting on this yoga, not divorced from it for even a single instant in your thought or in your physical and verbal conduct, you must nonetheless maintain your conduct the way it was before, with no radical shift. For instance, do not recite the words of mind training in others' presence, but strive to conform with others. Maintain the level of spiritual activity that you would normally engage in, and leave your external behaviors unchanged from before. Some people, after listening to the teaching, become fickle, leaving behind their past manner and practices. This is tantamount to forsaking your past, which is extremely inappropriate. And here's the sort of essence of it. Since it is taught that your mind training should be discreet yet effective, you should ripen your mind without others noticing. So again, this is a very important point, and often where we see people go astray is that often, the ego sort of hijacks our spiritual practice, and then we make a big outward display of our spiritual practice. You know, even, as I mentioned, sometimes put on this sort of funky Buddhist clothing and shave our head and wear all this sort of spiritual ornaments. And then we go around in public sort of boasting how spiritual we are and so forth. So again, then the ego is just hijacked ourselves. And then here also in this point, if we, even at a lesser degree than that, if we go home and the environment we are in is very conservative, then it's maybe not, and we feel that now we're actually sort of more or less a Buddhist and following the Buddhist way, it may be even good not to even mention to anyone that now we consider ourselves Buddhist, because we're just going to attract a lot of negative attention. And again, the more that we do that, the more likely it is that our ego has hijacked and now we're sort of showing off a little bit that we're trying to follow a spiritual path. So, and I can, this is from my own personal experience as well, is that, as this slogan says here, is that this practice is an inner transformation. Don't make it a big outward display, because again, it's a sure sign that our practice is being corrupted by the eight worldly concerns, and now we've just become a spiritual ego. And also, again, if we're coming in a very conservative community or environment, we're just going to attract a lot of negative attention. So if someone asks us, we can simply say we're just trying to be using wisdom and compassion in our lives to try and be a better person. And no one can argue with that. Question?
Yes, but Buddhism now became like a fashion.
Exactly. It's trendy, no?
Trendy, yeah.
Exactly. Spiritual ego. Classic. Classic. You know, it used to be before, I think, in some cultures, it was even a bit trendy to have a therapist, you know. But now it's more trendy, I think, to be a Buddhist, you know, or have a Buddhist guru. Yeah. That's very trendy, you know. Who's your guru? You know, my guru is very high. Is yours? I mean, really, I mean, it's...
Depending on the Dalai Lama.
Yes, you know, Dalai Lama's my guru. Who's your guru, you know? Is your guru as good as my guru? Maybe not. Sorry? Yeah. So again, here, I think this, if we can really take this to heart, it's going to be so helpful. Is really, don't make a big outward display. It's an inner transformation. maintain that humility. And again, if you're coming in, if you're living in a very conservative community or environment, I wouldn't even, and you consider yourself Buddhist, I wouldn't even tell anyone that you consider yourself Buddhist. Just implement these things, and when people see you improving, all you can say is, I'm just trying to use wisdom and compassion to be a better person in my life.
To be a Buddhist, it may be considered like to be religious. Like Buddhism is considered like one of the religions.
Okay.
Just to make a Buddhism as a way of life.
Exactly.
Philosophy.
I mean, this is often a big question.
Yeah.
And is Buddhism a religion or a way of life or science of mind? Or and recently I read an article from a modern-day scholar who had done a lot of research in the word religion and how the word religion is understood in our modern society. And basically his results were that in the world today, there are at least four major different ways of using the word religion, that people understand the word religion, at least four major different ways of understanding the word religion in the world today. And I had a look at each of those four definitions. I didn't actually take a copy of them. I wish I had, because it would be useful. But I remember at the time when I did look at those four different definitions of the word religion, then according to two of those definitions, Buddhism was not a religion, and according to two, it was. So it completely depends on how you define the word religion. Of course, one of the major ways of defining the word religion that's used today is the belief in a creator God. So if that's our idea of religion, of course, Buddhism's not a religion. But another one of the four was religion was defined as something that says there's something more than the mundane physical existence. There's something beyond that. And of course, in that sense, it is a religion. So I can't remember what the other two were. But so again, it really just depends on how you define the word religion.
Just on that last point about not transforming yourself. Along the path, sometimes you can come to some realizations that the job you're doing is very unwholesome, or the behavior you're doing. Or say you've got too much stuff, so you end up changing your job.
Sure.
Get rid of stuff. What's your advice in that way? What would you... keep it quiet and kind of...
Well, again, I mean, I think there doesn't have to be anything Buddhist about changing a job. I mean, obviously... If the job is toxic, you know, to ourselves and others, then, you know, it's obvious to others that it's also probably quite toxic and stressful and not helpful. And then, you know, you just say, well, I find this job very toxic and stressful and I'm not getting much out of it, so I'm going to find something more meaningful. So we don't have to say, I'm changing my job because I'm a Buddhist and therefore we shouldn't do this job. So, I mean, I think we can just be very simple about it. And many people now are changing their jobs because it's too much stress and it's not meaningful and so forth. And so if someone asks, we can just say, well, I don't find this job meaningful and I want to go into a more meaningful job that really fulfills me and makes my life more meaningful. And that doesn't have to be spiritual or religious or anything. No, it's just sensible. So I think that's how we can approach this. But on that point, one point, and then we need to move on again, is that often, you know, when people first come into contact with some spiritual system and they really feel like that could help them a lot in their life, then often they come up with this dilemma, you know, should I do the spiritual thing or should I do the career thing, you know? And then they find that they're sort of not sure. I think this is not a good way of thinking, because if we give up their career, how are we going to financially support ourselves? And two, maybe that career is the one thing we're good at, the one thing that we can do to benefit society. And if we've given that up, how are we going to benefit society? Are we going to sit in a cave for the rest of our life? I don't think so. So rather, we should look at integrating. You know, how can we use spiritual perspective to make our job more meaningful? And if we have that, we can, you know, we can even be doing some very menial job like sweeping the streets or cleaning toilets and still find that we're having a lot of benefit.
So it's the true gauge of the practice is to stay within a job if you find it hard, and you're finding it, the practice is showing to you that you can find goodness within that, rather
yeah.
than running away from
But of course, sometimes we go into a particular profession, not because we're good at it, but simply because we can make a lot of money. And maybe that profession is quite toxic and harmful to society, and within that, there's no way we can really shift that. Then we can think, well, okay, it's not something I'm even interested in. I have talents in other areas, and this is toxic to me and to society, and there's no way I can fix that, so let's do something else. So that could be an option. But generally, in most professions, we can shift our perspective to make our life more meaningful and do what we do to bring more benefit to the society. You know, I had recently, a couple of years ago, I had a person in during a course here came to with this dilemma, and they were in marketing, and they said they were very good at marketing, and they didn't say what they were marketing, but probably some, you know, rubbish stuff, that consumerism stuff that's not, you know, Coca-Cola or something, I don't know. So that's why he had the dilemma, because I think the things that he was marketing he didn't see of any value to society, and he was asking, well, should I give that up? But I think I'm quite good at that. Well, what can I do instead? And I said, don't give up marketing. Market useful things, you know. Go and work for companies, organizations that are marketing renewable energy and things that are useful to society. Use your talents to benefit society. So this, I think, many of us can do. We can find within our profession, maybe we have to move the company because maybe the company itself has this really negative, unethical stance. But of course, if we're in a company and we can exert influence, maybe we can make that company more ethical, so that could also be useful as well, you know. But if so generally I think for most of us we can find ways within our own professions to make that more meaningful. So again, here it's again the shift is about you know, if we have the eight worldly concerns, if we're looking out there for happiness, it's we're always looking about what we can get from the world, you know, what can I get from my job. And then, of course, we're never going to be satisfied. And the grass is always going to be greener on the other side of the hill. And that's why people keep shifting their job, because their craving and attachment is never satisfied. Even if it's an interesting job and you find it interesting, it's all about then, what can I get? What can I get? What can I get? And, of course, we never get enough. We can never get enough, because attachment can never get enough. So we keep shifting the job and completely unhappy. Oh, if I work for that company, then I'll be happy. Everything will be fine. And, of course, they shift. And because it's new and different, attachment goes, oh, yeah, this is interesting. Right, this is better. And then, of course, we stay there a while, and it's the same old, same old. And then attachment says, no. Nah. And, of course, attachment didn't realize. All it thought was, oh, I went to the wrong company. If I go to this company, then everything will be fine. And, of course, we just keep going round and round and round and round and dissatisfied, because it's all about what we can get. Whereas here, it's, again, the enemy-friend thing. It's all about what we can give, you know, what we can give rather than what we can get. So if we can make that shift through these adverse conditions, taking adverse conditions, what we can give in every job. We can give in every job.
It just comes outside in that way, because you find yourself, well, I found myself definitely, as Greta described, as downscaling on things. You know, you realise you don't need this so much, you start getting. And then people start to say, well, what's going on with him? Why is he? And then you have to start explaining yourself to people.
Yeah, but you don't have to say Buddhist. You can, I mean. It's the whole thing. I mean, I think most people now can understand that, you know, there's a lot of stress and dissatisfaction working lots of hours and. The biggest, you know, they've often done studies of people later in their life approaching death about their biggest regrets in life. And usually the number one regret across the board is regretting having worked so hard and just on the treadmill of a work existence and not done more meaningful things. This is one of the biggest regrets in life. So, I mean, we can just say this, that, like, I don't want to regret wasting my life and I want to do more meaningful things.
You know? So it's showing by example, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And then if you lead by example, then
explanation really to be given.
And then people see that somehow you know you've given up this and you're actually more happy and, you know, okay, maybe you're getting less money, but still you don't need that extra money anyway, so it's fine.
I had this, you know, because in Israel we have the army is obligatory thing to do.
Yeah, sure. But I think you can do social service, can't you?
Kind of. This is something, if you're religious, it's very complicated.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, a lot of times about the military thing.
Sure.
You know,
because
my brother, you know, he's very, like, he's pacifist, but he went to the army and he went to, you know, be a combat fighter. And part of our conversations about it was that, you know, if you don't go there, someone else that has
the worst,
yeah. So I mean, you do go to the army, you do have a weapon, you have to, you know, protect the borders.
Sure,
but
sure.
Do it in a more humane way.
Sure, exactly.
You know, so isn't it, even if you're, if for him and also for me, you know, it was more of a, in a way, a relief, because we know that if we weren't there, and even like most of my friends is going to be a commander or officers.
Sure.
They go in with their mind in a way that they could control the situation in a better way.
Exactly. That's what I was just saying, is that, you know, even if we find ourselves in a not a very good environment in our work, we can have a positive influence. And if we can have a positive influence, it may be actually useful to stay there to have that, particularly if we have some level position where we can filter that down in the organization. So this can also be a way of benefiting society, not just seeing that where we are is unethical, let's go more ethical, because, you know, we need to help society. And one way we can help society is to help other people become more ethical. So if we can do that within our work and our job, then fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's break for tea.
Last question. She reminded me of one thing. For instance, in Buddhism, no killing is one of the main precepts. Take Bhagavad Gita, like Bible for the Hindus.
Yeah.
There is Arjuna, who is the warrior, and Lord Krishna, the Lord himself. Saying him, it is your duty, you are born warrior, you are the warrior, you have to do your duty.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, he killed millions of people.
Right.
And the God himself says, it's your duty, you don't get any sin doing this, killing. Mm-hmm.
And we often have in Buddhism the warrior epitaph, the warrior idea, but of course, who are the enemy? Who is the demon? Not out there, it's in here.
Mm-hmm.
So in Buddhism, we also need to be a warrior and kill. And what we need to do is kill our mental afflictions, because that's the real enemy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real enemy. And I think a lot of these things, I don't know in that case, but a lot of these things we can also interpret to mean kill the inner demons, not the outer demons.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in Buddhism, we often have this idea of being a warrior and to kill the enemy. And of course, the enemy, as we saw here, is not out there, it's in here. It's our mental afflictions. That's what we need to vanquish and conquer. Okay, on that point, let's take a break and come back, and we'll continue on in the text.